Les colloques du Collège de France.
The last speaker of the afternoon, before the discussion, the general discussion, and the moment of the questions as well, is Natalie Pertz, who is Associate Professor of Arab Crossroads Studies and Anthropology at New York University, Abu Dhabi. And Natalie is a cultural anthropologist who has conducted ethnographic research in Yemen, Djibouti, and Somaliland. She's the author of Islands of Heritage, Conservation and Transformation in Yemen, published in 2018 and awarded of the Middle East Section Book Award. And the book deals with the impact on the environmental conservation, development and heritage project in pre-war Yemen. Her research explores shifting forms of sovereignty and governance in the Western Indian Ocean region. She's interested in the effects of international regulatory regime on the communities they intend to protect, including refugees, migrants, and ethnic or linguistic minorities. Attention to the experience of deportation or the constraints of development and humanitarian aid contributes, and this is her claim, to a better understanding of how this regime produced new forms of both mobility and immobility at global scale. So she's also the principal investigator for a collaborative interdisciplinary project on climate change, political economy, and connectivity in the Red Sea regions. And her talk today is, as you can read there, Migrants, Refugees, and Racial Borders in the Horn of Africa. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Sylvia, for this wonderful introduction. It is such an honor to be here, and I'm so grateful for the invitation. And thank you, everyone in the audience, for sitting through with us today for such a long but very diverse and rich set of presentations so far. Okay, in April 2020, thousands of Ethiopian migrants were expelled from northern Yemen. Rounded up and fired at by the Houthi militia, the migrants fled towards the Yemeni-Saudi border, where Saudi border guards began firing at them too. Caught between the Houthi and the Saudi fire, between the two opponents of Yemen's protracted war, scores of Ethiopians perished while hundreds escaped into the mountainous border area. Eventually, some survivors were apprehended and detained in Saudi Arabia. 2 months later, as many as 7,000 Ethiopian migrants remained stranded in what the migrants call the slaughter valleys along the Yemeni-Saudi border. Although the shooting of Ethiopian border crossers and the detention and deportation of migrants in Yemen and Saudi Arabia was not new, what sparked this episode was the stigmatization of these migrant and racialized bodies as coronavirus carriers. Just days earlier, Yemen's government in Aden had reported the country's first confirmed case of COVID-19. Nearly a month later, the Houthi authorities reported the first case of COVID in their territories, a case detected conveniently in the deceased body of a Somali refugee. As we have seen today, contemporary national borders are exclusionary, violent, lethal, and racial. This holds as true for liberal borders as it does for the borders of illiberal states, including the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Like the racially exclusionary migration governance regime of the European Union that seeks to block the unauthorized entry of non-white migrants and refugees from its territory only to include them as illegalized and racially subjugated labor, Saudi Arabia's kafala, or sponsorship system, subjugates millions of irregular and regular migrants to exploitative and blatantly racialized labor. This work permit system should not be dismissed as an exception to international migration governance. Rather, with Saudi Arabia hosting the world's third largest migrant population in 2020, following only the US and Germany, the kafala system is integral to racially differentiated migration and mobility globally. Saudi Arabia's racial borders exist not only at its territory, at its national boundaries, but throughout its territory, through its racially differentiated labor market. In addition, as Tendaya Achumi has argued, and as the April 2020 slaughter reveals, these racial borders are manifest in the bodies of the migrants themselves, whose blackness came to demarcate the fraught and decades-long border dispute between Yemen and Saudi Arabia as they were fired upon by security from both sides. Today, I will reflect on the racial borders that are constructed and maintained not just through this brutal violence at and within the territorial boundaries of Saudi Arabia, but also through the daily acts of humanitarian assistance and individual crossings along the way. Specifically, I will examine ways in which race is deployed as a border infrastructure to bifurcate, concretize, and police the otherwise fluid pathways and genealogies between migrants and refugees and Africans and Arabs along one of two major migration routes to the Arabian Peninsula. I argue that the border crossers themselves, with their acute understanding of how borders are racialized, deploy race as a technology for crossing borders too. Every year, thousands of South Asian and African aspiring migrants pay recruitment agents in their home countries hefty fees for a work permit that allows them to sell their labor in the Arab Gulf. Although these indebted migrants are authorized to work in the Arab Gulf states, the majority of low-skilled workers are housed in labor camps and slotted into sectors according to their nationality, which is to say, according to their ethnicity and race. At the same time, thousands of migrants and de facto refugees from Ethiopia and Somalia pay local brokers to facilitate their movement from the Horn of Africa to the Arabian Peninsula. The majority of these border crossers are undocumented Ethiopians seeking employment as domestic workers, manual laborers, shepherds, and construction workers in Saudi Arabia. To reach the kingdom, they walk for days across the deserts of Djibouti, board overcrowded open boats to cross the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden, and travel through war-torn Yemen, where they risk being kidnapped or detained and deported, in addition to physical and sexual abuse. This photograph and a number of the black and white photographs to follow were taken by the photographer Nadia Benchalal, who accompanied me on several of our field trips from 2016 to 2018. Despite the well-publicized risks, irregular labor migration from Ethiopia to Saudi Arabia has surged. One reason for its rise was Ethiopia's migration laws enacted to protect its citizens. In 2013, the Saudi government announced a seven-month amnesty during which undocumented migrants could regularize their employment status or leave the country without penalty. When the amnesty expired, police arrested, detained, tortured, and deported undocumented workers primarily from Yemen, Somalia, and Ethiopia. By 2014, more than 160,000 Ethiopians had been expelled. In response to this violent crackdown and reports of abuses in other Gulf states, the Ethiopian government banned low-skilled migration to the Gulf and Sudan. This ban was meant to be temporary, but was not lifted until 2018. During this period, aspiring migrants could no longer procure work contracts through the licensed overseas recruitment agencies that would enable them to travel by air. Irregular migration facilitated by smugglers became more prevalent, expensive, and dangerous at the same time that the criminalization of smuggling and the increase in border surveillance made the services of smugglers all the more essential. Nevertheless, even before and after the ban, most Ethiopian migrants prefer what they call the seaway over the passport to avoid the kafala system that ties workers to their sponsors, to dodge age restrictions on regular migration, or because they lack travel documents, could not afford the flights, or had personal connections with their brokers. Nor was the outbreak of the war in Yemen a deterrent. If anything, migrants were promised that the conflict made it easier to evade local authorities. Moreover, the majority of Ethiopian migrants are Oromo, who had been targeted by renewed government repression at home. That is, for many Ethiopians suffering from poverty, drought, and conflict, irregular cross-sea migration to Yemen and Saudi Arabia was a form of refuge. In March 2017, the Saudi government launched a new campaign against undocumented workers, giving them a 90-day amnesty. By March 2019, more than 260,000 Ethiopians had been deported. And yet, irregular migration from Ethiopia to the Arabian Peninsula increased. In both 2018 and 2019, the number of migrants and de facto refugees crossing the Red Sea exceeded the number of refugees and asylum seekers crossing the Mediterranean. This eastern corridor may have continued to be the world's busiest maritime migration route were it not for the outbreak of COVID, which led Saudi Arabia to close its borders and to ban travelers from Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Somalia, and a few other countries. Meanwhile, thousands of black and brown migrants were detained for months on end. In addition, thousands of Ethiopians were stranded in Yemen, where they became increasingly vulnerable to kidnapping and exploitation. In March 2022, the Ethiopian and Saudi governments reached an agreement to repatriate 100,000 Ethiopians languishing in Saudi deportation centers, detention centers, and this was all through the period of COVID. Exceeding their target, they repatriated more than 130,000 Ethiopians by this past April, just weeks after Saudi Arabia lifted its ban on travelers from Ethiopia. And the government of Ethiopia has just now launched its own migrant recruitment drive. Promised up to 500,000 job opportunities in Saudi Arabia, about the same number, incidentally or not, as the number of Ethiopians deported from Saudi Arabia since 2017, the Ethiopian government is offering orientations and flights for women to become domestic workers there. We're being told that this is an opportunity of a lifetime, a female recruit told a journalist just last month. It is unclear how effective this new government-regulated migration channel will be in curtailing the irregular route through Yemen. At present, the program is only open to medically fit adult women with no criminal record. This means that men and minors will continue to rely on smuggling networks. Women, too, may continue to choose this route for the same reasons they did before, including to avoid being tethered to a sponsor. 5 kilometers west of Obok, a small port town in northern Djibouti, and one of the primary departure points for sea travel to Yemen, is a migrant response center. Established by the International Organization for Migration in 2011, the center assists irregular migrants seeking to return to their home countries, in this case, Ethiopians returning from Yemen. This and its longer presence in the region distinguishes the center from the Markazi refugee camp established by the UNHCR in 2015 to house and protect refugees fleeing from Yemen. Managed by different multilateral organizations, serving categorically distinct populations, and separated by the very artery that connects Djibouti City to the port of Obok, these two compounds reflect and reify what Rebecca Hamlin calls the migrant-refugee binary. The legal and sociological distinction drawn between those who are viewed as voluntary and often economically motivated migrants who can be legitimately excluded by their potential host states, and those viewed as forced or often politically motivated refugees who should be let in. Even the compound's architecture reinforces this divide. In the IOM Center, migrants are provided temporary shelter and communal dorm rooms surrounding an interior courtyard. In the Markazi camp, refugees are provided air-conditioned single household dwellings surrounded by a chain-link fence. If the camp makes this multitude of refugees and their need for a durable solution visible to the local and international community, the center conceals the accumulation of migrants and their unendurable peregrinations from view, except when the center is occupied beyond capacity and the migrants congregate and sleep and die outside its walls. Paradoxically, the road that bifurcates these two populations is the same road that each border crosser traveled as they were shuttled to their respective compounds after their arrival in the port of Obok. Both migrants and refugees cross one or more international borders without authorization. Both populations fled political conflict and violence in their homelands with the hope of securing a living wage and a viable future elsewhere. Both had suffered the same adversities, including deportation from Saudi Arabia, aerial bombardment by the Saudi-led coalition, and forced conscription or harassment by the Houthis. And both populations are comprised of individuals who migrated back and forth between the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, as well as back and forth across this conceptual divide, migrants becoming legally recognized refugees or asylum seekers, and refugees becoming migrants. The Southern Red Sea region is often characterized as a transit region for bidirectional mixed migration flows between Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. Yet, in addition to being comprised of individuals all migrating for a variety of reasons, these Red Sea movements are oscillating and multi-generational. They also comprise border crossers distinguished less by nationality than by ethnicity: Arab, Oromo, Amhara, Tigray, Somali, Afar, as well as a large number of individuals who are considered biracial or mixed race due to their African and Arab descent. What I am arguing here is that it is racial borders, or even what Karen Fields and Barbara Fields call race craft, that is, the illusion of race produced by the practice of racism, that works in the Red Sea region to maintain the migrant-refugee binary, even among those migrating in the same boat. Specifically in Djibouti, this racecraft turns Ethiopians moving toward the Arabian Peninsula into illegalized economic migrants, while turning Yemenis in the Horn of Africa into refugees with international protection. Although these distinctions may seem self-evident, the Yemenis are escaping a war, the Ethiopians are seeking employment, they leave little room for the complex motivations and trajectories that belie this legal fiction. While this is a fiction that both the UNHCR and IOM, or OIM, I think in French, are constituted to maintain, the so-called refugees and migrants are well aware of their shared histories and vulnerabilities. In their common parlance, the two opposing compounds are less often described as a refugee camp and a migrant center than as a center for Arabs and a center for Oromo, Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, or a derogatory term for Ethiopians is used. In other words, while the so-called refugees and migrants subvert these legal distinctions through their own discourse and practice, they reinscribe them through ethnicity or race. This is illuminating precisely because many of the refugees from Yemen are not, in fact, racialized as purely Arab. Rather, they are the mixed African-Arab offspring of Yemeni men who had emigrated to the Horn of Africa to escape Yemen's rigid caste-like system of social stratification based on profession and presumed Arab or African descent. Although the two Yemen republics sought to eradicate these status differentials in the 1960s, the regime of Unified Republic of Yemen that came into existence in the 1990s exalted Yemen's Arab tribal identity. As a consequence, black Yemenis, who used to be called akhdam, or servants, but now self-identify as mahamashin, the marginalized ones, continue to be treated as social outcasts and consigned to low-status labor, particularly garbage collection. And the African Arab return migrants, called Mawaladin, which Yemenis translate into English as half-breed or half-caste, feel increasingly ostracized too. "We could not get a good life in Yemen," a Somali Yemeni man in his 60s told me in English. "When you're black, nobody trusts you. You need to have a tribe, you know? Even if you do have a strong tribe, but if you're black, you'll be treated like a derogatory term. No one will respect you." It was this social alienation in Yemen, compounded by racial discrimination, a patronage system favoring those with strong tribal connections, and the continued scapegoating of migrants and Mawaladin for Yemen's social and economic problems, as much as it was the war itself, that drove many to seek refuge abroad. In April 2015, the government of Djibouti granted prima facie recognition or refugee status to all asylum seekers from Yemen. Yemenis living in the Markazi camp maintain that they have acquired more rights and value as UNHCR-recognized refugees than they had had as citizens in Yemen. "At least I have a leg to stand on in this camp. I have all the rights as refugees do," a Somali Yemeni widow told me in 2016. "As a child of the UN," as several put it, These black and other marginalized Yemenis felt that they had acquired an ascendant status. "I was like a refugee in Yemen, but without international recognition, a virtual refugee. Now I am a real refugee," ostensibly or so-called low-status man told me in 2018. As refugees, these Yemenis believe that they've now been granted a choice among UNHCR's three durable solutions, that is repatriation, resettlement, and return to Yemen, whereas as former migrants, their futures had been constrained. In addition, as refugees living in the so-called Arab camp, they received superior shelter and assistance from Gulf state charities, not just in comparison to the migrants in the center across the street, but also in comparison to displaced Eritreans and Afar pastoralists with Djiboutian nationality who live all around them. This Arab camp houses also several Somali, Ethiopian, and Eritrean families who had previously been refugees in Yemen. Some told me that they had insisted upon being housed among the Arabs, expecting that the conditions in this camp would be better than Djibouti's two older camps for refugees from the Horn. Finally, the structural bifurcation between Black migrants and Arab refugees aids in the re-racialization of Black Yemenis as Arab. These racial borders, albeit in practice ever fluid, are concretized by other forms of humanitarian assistance and care, notably in the hiring of Ethiopian migrants as the refugee camp's garbage collectors, a job and status formerly associated with the Yemeni Mohammeshin. As the Oromo walk through the camp, picking up its overflowing trash, their mobile Black bodies demarcate the categorical borders between migrants and refugees, Africans and Arabs, not unlike the ways in which the targeted Ethiopian migrants demarcated the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The careful maintenance of these racial borders and the construction of these racial borders through humanitarian care occurs not only in and around these IOM and UNHCR-supported facilities, but also through the racialized interpolations of Ethiopians as voluntary, economically motivated migrants along their days-long journey through Djibouti. In early 2018, while walking through Djibouti's historic center, my attention was drawn to two new billboards. The first displayed a color photograph of a woman being lifted out of the surf by two men, one of whom was also clutching a toddler. The other billboard, directly facing the city's Hamoudi Mosque, built in 1906 by Hajj Hamoudi, a migrant from Yemen, displayed a black and white photograph of people crowded into a boat at night. What the images were lacking in context, they tried to make legible through French and Arabic language captions. Below the image of the near-drowning woman and child, it read, "The longest journey to the most uncertain end." If that message was a little cryptic, the second image with the overcrowded boat was more direct. Do you know that you are heading to a war zone? As their logos revealed, the images were part of the UNHCR's Dangerous Crossing campaign. Launched in early 2017, the campaign aimed to warn refugees and migrants heading toward the Arabian Peninsula of the risks that lay ahead. Featuring multilingual songs, radio spots, and print media advisories, the campaign targeted four countries in the Horn and had reached more than 8 million people by social media by June 2018. What was less clear was its impact on the migrants along the way. How many Oromo, Amhara, Tigrinya, and Somalis en route to Yemen were moved by these messages? How many youths from Ethiopia and Somalia were able to read the French and the Arabic if they were able to read at all? And if they could not decipher the captions, then what did the posters convey through their imagery? If the would-be border crossers could not read that they were heading toward an unknown outcome or into a war zone, what they could in all likelihood read was their own racialization through these images. In the photograph of the woman being rescued from the sea, the woman's colorful headscarf and matching dress clearly marks her and her red-jacketed son as Somali border crossers. In contrast, her two male rescuers in their white-colored shirts and the utility vests appear to be Djiboutian or international employees of the UNHCR or IOM. When I presented the image to refugees from Yemen and to a Djiboutian social scientist, both claimed with certainty that the male rescuers were Arab, either Arab, Djiboutian, or Yemeni. It was their clothing, but also their stature, the standing Arab men rescuing the half-drowning African migrants, that marked them less than their appearance or their skin tone. On the second billboard featuring the boat, one sees seven young men sitting at the bow in front of an indistinguishable multitude of black bodies. Dark and shadowy, this nighttime photograph stood in stark contrast not only to the woman being rescued, but also to the billboard image immediately to its right, featuring a plump, honey-colored toddler building a brick tower in an advertisement for Bladina baby cereals. Do you know you're heading to a war zone? the black and white photograph asks of the black young men who are already underway. Enriched with essential nutrients to support brain growth and brain development, the bright green advertisement assures middle-class parents, suggesting that their well-nourished children will have a bright future. Indeed, through this all likelihood accidental pairing, but one that may have boosted Bladina sales far more than its poster alone, the advertisement promises its viewers even more, that their children, nurtured on Bladina, will have all the opportunities that the black border crossers and the black Somali toddler do not, that their children will be protected from dangerous sea crossings and from the dangers that lie across the sea. We might ask then, how did the juxtaposition of these images speak to the would-be border crossers, if at all? Would individuals who had come so far already see the images, the posters, and be persuaded to abandon their journey and return home? Or might some have even imagined that their earnings in Saudi Arabia could afford them the prospects of nurturing their own babies with middle-class products like Bladina? In June 2018, dozens of Ethiopian migrants died of cholera on the highway to Obok. It was not the dramatic sea crossing or the war zone that ended their journey, simply contaminated water along the way. Several young men died within a stone's throw of the migrant center. The following year, the IOM rolled out a new awareness campaign. This time, a series of billboards erected alongside the migratory route replaced the images of transit and rescue with images of certain death. One billboard depicted a woman and a man donning an IOM-branded vest walking toward a white body bag lying on a heavily footprinted beach. That's another one image then. The next billboard depicted four men carrying a heavy body bag across the beach. These two alternating images grace one billboard after another, from Lake Roubette in central Djibouti to right outside the migrant center. Their messaging had become more urgent, too. Choose life, the billboards instruct their passersby in French, Arabic, and now Amharic. Nevertheless, as in the UNHCR campaign rolled out the year before, the dangers they flagged remain limited to the perils of the Red Sea crossing and not to the hazards encountered along the route, or the struggles that had motivated these Ethiopians to leave their homes in the first place. Choose life, the sign said, and the migrants did. They continued to walk. I lied to you. I looked up from my notebook, where I was taking note of the conversations I'd had with Ethiopian migrants inside the migrant center, to see a migrant named Hassan standing beside me. I'm not Ethiopian at all. I'm Yemeni. Asli, pure Yemeni, Hassan continued. Hassan was one of the migrants who approached me as I was leaving the center to ask me if I could tell them when the bus would arrive. Every month or two, when the center reached full capacity, the IOM office arranged buses to repatriate the returner stranded migrants to Ethiopia. It was October 2018. The men who circled around me had been sitting around for weeks waiting to return home. For many, this would not be a joyful homecoming. Some had been deported from Saudi Arabia to Yemen, others had been imprisoned in Yemen. Despite the IOM's commitment to voluntary return, few of the migrants in the center were likely to say that their return to Ethiopia was voluntary. Instead, they had just been unlucky. They'd run out of money, they'd been robbed, they'd been beaten and threatened. They were now recuperating and biding their time until their next attempt to reach Saudi Arabia. I was struck by Hassan's perfect Arabic. When I asked him about his background, he told me that he was half Yemeni, half Ethiopian, born in Yemen, on his way to Addis Ababa, where his mother and siblings live. As I left the migrant center to head back to the refugee camp across the street, Hassan must have reevaluated what he wanted me to know. Both his mother and father were living in Sana'a, he told me, as were his siblings. In fact, he had no family in Addis Ababa at all. Inside the center, surrounded by economic migrants, Hassan was an Ethiopian migrant returning to his family. Outside the center, walking alongside me to the refugee camp, Hassan was a Yemeni refugee trying to reach another country to complete his education there. On both sides of the wall, he was just 14. So you told the IOM that you're Mawalid, half Ethiopian? Yes, but it was a lie. I gave them the number of my Ethiopian friend and said he was my brother and that my mother was there. If I said I was Yemeni, they wouldn't have let me go. What Hassan meant was that the IOM would not have given him a free transfer from Obok to Addis Ababa, nor would he have been able to secure a visa to enter Ethiopia legally. The IOM bus for returning migrants was Hassan's ticket to Addis, and eventually, he hoped, his onward journey to Europe, as long as this Yemeni refugee could pass as an Ethiopian migrant. Indeed, Hassan's ability to present himself as a returning Ethiopian migrant depended on his ability to pass as black. Hassan told me that he and his friend Ali had intentionally attempted to darken their skin. They sunbathed during the boat ride from Yemen to Djibouti and spent their first few weeks in Obok soaking up the color at the shore, or soaking up color. A month later, I received a call from Hassan. He was in Addis Ababa, eager to know if I would be visiting Ethiopia anytime soon, but I was not able to travel then and eventually lost contact with him. For all I know, Hassan has made it to Cairo, maybe even to France. I may never know if his unsolicited confession was not just another lie he had fabricated to facilitate his onward travel. What I do know is that he thought to deploy the ambiguities between Arab Yemenis and African Yemenis and the slippages between refugees and migrants to cross between these otherwise distinct categories and structures. Hassan's ability and audacity to embody blackness provided him in this instance with a way out. They die on the streets, Hanan said, referring to the Ethiopian migrants whose accumulation of footprints Hanan, Selma, and I were tracking alongside the beach in 2019. The problem is that no one has mercy on them, Selma said, not the organizations or the Djiboutians. We went out about a week before you arrived and we saw a man who was barely able to walk upright. We asked him, "What's wrong with you?" And another man, who knew to speak Arabic, said, "We're exhausted." We asked him where they're going, and he said, "Yemen." He said this was the smuggling route. He said he'd been to Yemen before, but now he's too tired. He doesn't want to go back again. I asked what he wanted, and he said he was hungry. "They are truly unfortunate," Hanan said. "Sometimes they can't even speak Arabic and will just say mama and put their fingers to their mouths," Selma demonstrated, "and your heart just aches." Although the migrants are not permitted to enter the refugee camp unless they are hired as garbage collectors, they do enter daily in search of food. Selma, Hanan, and other women in the camp set aside their leftovers on a regular basis. "If I have anything, I'll give it to them," Hanan said, "and sometimes they'll ask me if they should wait, and I'll tell them to come back in a little while. I'll purposely make extra rice and sauce and then give them a plate of food and a bottle of water." "Honestly, the problem is that the organizations don't have any sympathy for the refugees," Selma said, using the same Arabic term to refer to the migrants, lajeen, that is used for refugees. "They say this is smuggling, that these people decided freely to move this way. They smuggled themselves. What do we have to do with it? It's none of our business." Selma, Hanan, and I continued walking, adding our footprints to the wide swath of prints left by the migrants who had walked there before us. Some had been wearing shoes, but most had walked barefoot, their footprints the physical remainder of their spectral passing. "The organizations don't see that this is a human who's far from home and tired. There's no mercy. It should be mandated that any car belonging to an aid organization that passes by and sees someone in that state, whether they're Oromo, Ethiopian, Somali, or Arab, that they have to help them. Especially because they are children, not even adults. When you came in October during the rains, we saw little girls playing in the water and asked them where they were going. They said, Yemen. They were Hayat's age," Selma said, referring to Hanan's 12-year-old daughter. "I don't know how their parents allow it," Hanan said. "People say that some of them are trafficked. It's very upsetting, I swear to God, because no one will have mercy on them, not in Djibouti or Yemen or Saudi Arabia," Selma said. "They beat them. I swear to God," Hanan said. "There's a compound near Bab el-Mandeb that they are taken to, and if they don't have money, they're beaten." "Yes, I heard that," I said. "They even have to call their parents and ask for money, even though they may not have had any to start with." "And those who don't have a mother or father," Selma said, "they prefer death. Once I asked a boy, 'Why are you running away from Ethiopia? What about your mother?' I told him Ethiopia's a beautiful and green and asked why he wanted to run away," Hanan said. "I said his mother will cry. He told me his mother had died. It is very upsetting." "At least we can fend for ourselves. We have something. But them, they don't really have anything," Selma, the refugee, said. As we walked, Selma talked about the camp guards beating the Oromo, the numbers of migrants staying in the center, and the bus transfers that were underway. "What can we do? We can't do anything," Hanan said. "We tell them we're refugees like you are," Selma explained. "If the racial borders between refugees and migrants are constructed and reinforced by facially neutral regimes of humanitarian care, They are also slowly but repeatedly eroded by these everyday encounters and small acts of compassion. It takes work to uphold racial borders, borders that the refugees from Yemen who are eager to buttress both their refugee status and their racialization as Arab work hard to maintain. And yet it is in these fleeting moments of care and commensality that some distinctions collapse. In November 2021, when I returned to the camp after a long COVID absence, I found Selma hosting two Ethiopian women. One was 20 years old and 9 months pregnant. Originally from Addis Ababa, Ada had reached the Saudi border just weeks before the Houthi forces had expelled the migrants on the pretext of them being coronavirus carriers. Ada may have found herself among this group had she not been held captive already by her Ethiopian smuggler, who raped her repeatedly during the nearly 2 years she worked in his home. Eventually, Ada escaped and received money from her brother for her return journey. She did not want to return to Ethiopia, however, where her mother had died and her father had remarried, and had requested asylum in Djibouti. At the time I met her, Ada was living at the migrant center, awaiting the delivery of her child, the child of her captor, so that she could be transferred to Djibouti's Holho camp for refugees from Yemen, from Ethiopia. During these weeks, Ada frequently visited Selma, herself a victim of gender-based violence, who baked cakes for her clandestine guests. Both women dreamed of being resettled to the US. To conclude, the structured juxtaposition of refugees and migrants and Arabs and Africans in Obok provides a valuable lens through which to unpack how nation states, international organizations, and border crossers deploy race to both uphold and subvert the migrant-refugee binary that affords choice to a select few while vilifying the migratory choices of the majority. It is productive precisely because it shows the ways in which national identity is conflated with race. Yemenis are Arab, Ethiopians are Black, and how embodied race is itself, of course, artificial and malleable. It is no surprise, then, that regulating borders according to nationality entails racializing them, the bodies that cross them, and the movements toward these borders. The racial borders encountered in places like Obok are not only the top-down constructs of states and migration governance regimes. Rather, the border crossers themselves, acutely aware of how racial borders function, must sometimes exert their own racecraft to cross borders or to try to pry them open. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.